lead bank and agent bank liability. We need to understand the legal duties and responsibilities of all of the parties so that we can manage their respective liabilities inter se. As a core lawyer, a commercial lawyer, a corporate lawyer, as a finance lawyer, we need to be able to advise our clients on their role and functions and then possible liability, heads of liability, and then how we can limit and allocate that liability in practice. What we will do in these large complex transactions and complex documentation, we're going to allocate responsibility for specific loss to the parties generally most able to bear that. And so long as everybody understands the allocation that's affected, we will secure the overall objectives of the transaction and the party's intent. What we need to be careful of is that no other ancillary or other types of heads of liability could arise which could generate liability for our specific clients. What are all of the possible heads of liability that we need to look at? In the financial area, we generally assumed that there was only limited areas of possible concern that we had to be aware of. Specific difficulties arose in 1976 with the famous decision in the Raycol-Cotronis case. That was Raycol-Cotronis Tankers Securities Litigation, 1976. What had happened was European American Banking Corporation, EABC, had set up a syndicate with a number of regional American banks to provide syndicated facilities to the shipping group, the Colcotronis Group. The participating banks argued, after a failure to repay, that the lead bank had a duty to advise them on all material facts relevant to the credit, and because of its experience in international financial markets, it had specific obligation to advise on the possible liabilities that could have arisen. In that particular case, Raycol-Cotronis, the lead bank, decided to cover all of the losses and repay all of the funds involved because it admitted that it had made untrue statements of fact or omitted other facts. This caused very significant concern in the markets. Lawyers hadn't anticipated, and their bankers that they were advising hadn't considered the possible scope of liability that could arise. After this, everybody now focuses on this issue of party liability in these large, complex transactions. We need to consider what are the possible heads of liability, and we need to ensure that our client does not incidentally, accidentally, or in any other way commit conduct which could create some form of unforeseen liability. What are we looking at? Common law misrepresentation, statutory misrepresentation, and statutory deceit, that's under the Theft Act 1968. We've also got agency liability, fiduciary duty, and regulatory liability, regulatory duty. In terms of misrepresentation, at common law, we can have innocent, negligent, and fraudulent misrepresentation. We also have fraudulent misrepresentation under the Theft Act, as I've mentioned, and also statutory misrepresentation under the Misrepresentation Act 1967. The reason we brought into effect the Misrepresentation Act 1967 was that we always had liability for fraudulent misrepresentation, but you had to actually establish fraud, which was a very high standard of proof to have to be able to discharge. So what they effectively did is, under the Misrepresentation Act 1967, Section 2.1, is that we reverse the burden of proof. In cases where, if we could have established fraud, there would have been clear liability and the right to rescind. In such cases, we no longer have to establish fraud. We just have to prove the misrepresentation, and then the burden of proof shifts. So we create a defence that the other party can prove that they had reasonable grounds to believe and did believe at the time the contract was entered into that the facts were true. So you reverse the burden of proof. Instead of having to establish overt fraud, full fraud, it turns itself around. You prove misrepresentation, and the other party has to establish that they reasonably believe the statement to be true at the time. So this very significantly lowers the burden of proof, which was a major obstacle before. So we need to consider each of these possible heads of liability. How will this arise in practice? It's very simple. We've set up this large facility. We've got $100 million at stake And what will happen is the borrower cannot repay. In these particular cases, for some reason, we can't go against the guarantors or anybody else. The point is the syndicate is going to lose 100 million, possibly 10 million each, if it was 10 banks and 100 million drawdown. The question is, who can the banks sue? They can consider the other banks, but they haven't done anything and had no duty to each other because it was all several. We know this already because each loan agreement is several and distinct. It creates several and independent obligations. Each of the banks is undertaking their own credit assessment. Although we can have hundreds, if not thousands, of loans created under a single document, the document itself is only sets out the terms, collective terms, common terms and conditions under which the facility will be issued. The question is, how can we establish liability in such cases? Because everything is several. So the banks will then have to consider who else could they sue. So who do they have? They have the lead bank and they have the agent bank. So we need to consider how we can determine the limits of liability of the agent bank and lead bank in practice. How are we going to do that? In the paper, I explain the various heads of liability. I outline all of the key points of common law, innocent, negligent, and fraudulent liability. I've given examples of case law, and I explain how all of this operates in the chapter. What we then need to think is how we can control and manage this in practice and how we can deal with this in the documentation that we're drafting. We're going to do that with three key sets of provisions. We're going to think about limited duty clauses, or what we call basis clauses. Limited duty or basis. We're then going to look at limited liability. We're then going to look at exclusion of liability and any controls on the exclusion of liability. And then we're going to look at remedy. In terms of remedy, as I've explained before, when we look through and we work through the main documentation, including specifically the standard common documentation that would be used in a typical loan agreement, I think there's five key sets of remedies. Suspension or withholding of further advance, cancellation of the obligation to make further advances, acceleration of repayment, rescission of the documentation, and then sue for damages. So we know what the remedies are. How can we control liability to avoid having to rely on those remedies? Three key sets of provisions. Limited duty. The easiest way to limit liability is not to have a duty to breach in the first case. So through a limited duty clause or a basis clause, you narrow your scope of responsibility. Therefore, you can't breach something if you weren't responsible for carrying out that function in the first place. So limited duty or basis clauses are the easiest way to do this. And what I've done in the chapter and in the heading, I've given examples of this in the documentation. So no duty provisions, information supply provisions, own credit assessment rules, non-reliance rules, no fiduciary duty. All of this is provided for in the standard documents that we're looking at, and I've included specific references to particular sample provisions that you have, so we can understand and see how all of this operates in practice. There has been some interesting case law in this area. There was one particular recent case which actually qualified this slightly. It seemed to indicate that you basically couldn't use these limited duty clauses in case where a reasonable test would otherwise apply. The case was First Tower Trustees versus CDS. I've put a case note on the system about this because I had to comment on this for the Encyclopedia of Banking, which I was editor of. Leg J creates a qualification whereby if the effect of the limited clause is to otherwise exclude the application of the reasonableness test, which would apply under the Unfair Contract Terms Act, and we'll come on and look at that in further detail. It's referred to further below on the table. We import a reasonableness test in all cases to determine whether this should be given effect to. If the effect of the basis clause would be to exclude the application of the reasonableness test, it's ineffective. That was a narrow application of the rules in one particular case which hadn't been determined on that basis before. A number of the other cases following that, including specifically Premium Credit Limited versus Primary Care Management and Motor Act versus Good Life Foods, and interacted e-solutions all adopt a much more open, generous interpretation, which reflects their law as we understood it before. This is an interesting case. It creates one qualification, but it doesn't change the law materially in this particular case. There's a case note on this, on the system, as well as a separate, further, more detailed case note with regards to all of the other key, most important recent decisions in this area, which I've summarised further down, including IFE Funds versus Goldman Sachs, PK Intermark, Deepak Fertilizers, and also this comment on the Abu Dhabi case. So we have these basis clauses, these limited duty clauses. This is the easiest way to limit liability. We then also have exclusion clauses. We can't expressly exclude. We are not responsible for loss that will arise in the event of this. These are perfectly legitimate. These are perfectly legal. There's a whole series of famous cases under English law which confirm all of this in practice. Hood versus Anchor King, Swiss Atlantique, Photo Productions. There's important case law which confirms the validity of these. The only problem is, in practice, that will be subject to this reasonableness test, which is imported under the Unfair Contract Terms Act 1977, which I refer to further below on point 4C(b). So, we can have exclusion of liability. Other remedies arise, for example, set-off, estoppel, indemnity, and contributory negligence. We can use all of these either separately or in combination to further limit our liability. Set-off is a form of right or entitlement to compare or use another obligation that's due from the same party to avoid having to pay under the specific obligation. Set-off refers to the basis for payment. It can either be legal, equitable, contractual, bankers or insolvency, and I explain all of this in the paper. That's contrasted with netting. Netting is a form of contractual right which sets off specific obligations under a particular payment obligation under a particular contract. So set off more generally extinguishes mutual obligations under law. Netting is a specific type of set off which applies in particular contractual situations. We also have indemnity. Even if an exclusion clause is held to be illegal, you can still have a legal indemnity clause. And we'll see that when we look at some exercises in this area. So even if for some reason, either the exclusion clauses weren't properly imported, or they didn't apply, or they were held to be unreasonable for any of these reasons, and you are still technically liable, you can still get separate indemnity for the loss you would otherwise have to pay. So we need to watch that. And then you've also got what's called contributory negligence. Under the Law Reform Contributory Negligence Act, if loss arises, if somebody else is partly responsible for that, possibly 50-50, the court will allocate the loss 50-50. It will share the allocation. So there's these other additional ways of closing down liability. However, there are exclusions on the exclusion of liability. There's limits on our ability to limit liability. We need to consider these. Construction, first of all. Everything is construed contra proferentem against the person drafting them, against the person relying on them. So strict interpretation. You also have no application of these exclusion clauses in five conditions. Fraud or fraudulent misrepresentation, criminal liability, statutory liability, where the clause itself was misrepresented or there was a separate oral statement that overrides the statement that was in the initial documentation. So in each of these cases, you cannot rely, you cannot exclude liability. Then we have statutory controls. The two key sets of provisions were the Consumer Contract Regulations. This is now restated in the Consumer Rights Act 2015 and the Unfair Contract Terms Act. We're not concerned with the consumer rights because these are domestic transactions which do not apply in the large international finance contracts that we're looking at in this class. So we only have to consider the Unfair Contract Terms Act. That's specifically imported into misrepresentation situations by the Misrepresentation Act. I've summarised the key provisions here and in the text in further detail. You also have copies of the statutes on the system as well. You just need to work through these. Basically, we cannot exclude liability for death and personal injury. In all other cases, it has to be reasonable, having regard to the circumstances of the specific case. And then the way we determine that measure, that reasonableness, is set out in the schedule to the Unfair Contract Terms Act. All of that's provided for in further detail in the paper. What I then do is I look at some of these cases in further detail. I focus specifically on this Ray Colquatronis case, which is a very important recent case. Every possible head of liability was raised. What had happened was there was GKA notes issued, which were tied to Russian government bonds. The Russian government defaulted, and there was massive losses on the bonds. The Greek shipping family, Polemis, they sued JP Morgan Chase under every possible head of liability you can imagine, in contract, in tort, all of the possible areas of liability were considered and were stated in that case. It's a very interesting case simply because of its comprehensive examination of all of the law in these areas. Mrs. Justice Gloucester, in that specific case, which involved suing for $500 million, and that was the Springwell family. Well, it was their company, it was the, Polemis. It was Adam Polemis who'd been dealing with Jason Aitkenson, J.A., at JP Morgan Chase, and they alleged that there was misadvice, misrepresentation, or insufficient advice provided, so the bank was responsible for the loss that arose. The court essentially considers all of these types of arguments, the no duty, the limited liability, and it upholds all of this. It confirms all of this. Specifically, the exclusion clauses are considered not to be exclusion clauses, but no duty clauses. Therefore, they narrow the liability, and there's no reason to consider the unreasonableness test in any case, although in this particular case, everything's considered to be reasonable anyway. What I also do is I explain these other main cases, IFE funds, PK, DPAC, which are all very important because they support all of this. What we get is this. In practice, it is very difficult for clients to sue the banks because the banks will use all of these provisions to protect their position. And so long as this is reasonable and proper in the particular case, that's the way it should have been. There's one other qualification to make in this Abu Dhabi case. One of the issues which arose was whether the client was entitled to rely on credit rating agency figures. One of the key causes of the global financial crisis was that many investors across the markets and across the world were buying assets, specifically structured finance assets, including collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, relying on credit rating agency figures. They had no contractual relationship with the credit agency company. They had no right of recourse. And these credit ratings were prepared for other companies who did have a direct right of action. But even then, they couldn't sue because of the various exclusion and exclusion clauses, disclaimer clauses that were imported into that contractual provision. The whole of the market was relying on these. And the court in the Abu Dhabi case considered that it was reasonable for the client in that case to do so. My own opinion is that's completely wrong. That was a major factor in causing the global financial crisis, although, as in all of these other cases, with all of the other purchases of such instruments, the person buying the asset, the CDO or whatever else it is, they're responsible for making a credit assessment, determining the possible risk attached to that asset, and coming up with a proper price to pay for it. Everybody has to undertake their own caveat emptor. Of their own responsibility to price the risk and to determine whether it's appropriate to buy or not buy. They are not entitled to rely on ratings and figures that were prepared by other companies for other interests, for other parties against which they have no claim, they have no right. You could almost call this a third-party situation. And very often in finance law, we disapply third-party rights. This is a clear example of that type of situation. I think the court was very wrong and erred in that particular case. In all of these other cases, however, essentially the court upholds all of this. The limited duty, the basis clauses, the limited liability, and the narrow application of the controls and restrictions on this, including specifically the reasonableness in these particular cases. Because very often we're dealing with large companies, professional companies, and other major wholesale professional counterparties in the markets. So it's very difficult to hold such specific protections and applications unreasonable in these particular cases. So what we can do is this, we can understand all the possible heads of liability, we can look at all of the different means of controlling and limiting that in practice, and also outline the various possible remedies which could apply in the event that all of this fails. I've also referred to all of the main case law, either in the note itself or in the supporting notes that you have on the system. This is a very important area of practical application of finance and general commercial contract and tort law in practice.